This podcast is proudly sponsored by Aspire Autism Consultancy, the leading providers of autism and ADHD training, educating and enabling families, therapists, and healthcare professionals to gain knowledge and understanding of neurodiversity. The courses are written by two specialist psychotherapists and include the voices and lived experiences of neurodivergent individuals. For further details, go to www.aspireautismconsultancy.co.uk. Welcome to Different Minds, the podcast series about the different ways our brains can work and interpret information. When Suzanne Alderson's 14-year-old daughter became suicidal in 2015, following a period of sustained bullying, Suzanne found herself in a desperate place, facing an uncertain future with life support and even less understanding. While her daughter was immediately wrapped in professional care, Suzanne found that there was no support available to help her or her husband make sense of the situation and give their child the best kind of care. One night on suicide watch, she decided if she ever got through this time, she would ensure no other family had to go through this alone. In 2016, as her daughter improved, she set up a Facebook group to try and help other families facing their child's mental illness. The community called Parental Mental Health is now a registered charity with a mission to end generational mental illness and help 1 million parents by 2025. To talk about this and more, I'm delighted to be joined by Suzanne Alderson, founder at Parental Mental Health, community leader, public speaker, and author of Never Let Go, How to Parent Your Child Through Mental Illness. Suzanne, welcome to Different Minds.
Thank you, John. Thanks for having me. Nice to be here.
No worries. So here we are recording this October 2021. How has this year been for you?
Wow, this year it's been, I think, the hangover from 2020. I've definitely felt it. But we've had a huge increase in demand for the services at Parenting Mental Health. So it's been a very, very busy one. Very, very busy.
I want to go back to 2015. And I wonder if you could just tell me a little bit more about the difficult time that you had with your daughter at that time.
Yeah, of course. Well, we'd had some issues beforehand, and my daughter Izzy was being bullied at school, and I hadn't really understood the scope of the impact of that. And in sort of true fixer parent fashion, I'd thought if we could just get her through this time, carry on doing it, you know, shoo her into school. You know, we didn't speak to the school actually because she didn't want us to. She was very, very cautious around that. She didn't want to be ostracized. She didn't want to be highlighted or identified even any more than she already was being by the bullies. But I kind of felt that if we could just get her through this time, we'd be okay. And gradually we saw her, well, on reflection, we saw her mental health decline over the months. And it got to a point where she was really, really struggling. And we were struggling as well because we were losing sight of her. We'd lost that effervescent, creative, quirky, funny young person that she was. And as I say, she didn't want us to go and speak to the school. But in the end, my husband and I were absolutely pulling our hair out. And in the end, he went and spoke to the school. And they said that they would move the bullies from her class. We were at the end of the summer term and we went off into the summer holidays thinking, fantastic, this is all kind of gone away. We could see elements of her mental health declining over that summer. We couldn't go on a plane. We were due to go to Italy on holiday and she decided that she couldn't go on a plane with people. She decided that she couldn't go to a hotel with too many people either. So we ended up driving to a house where we spent a week with her, basically isolating herself more and more. But when we came to September, she said to me, I can just remember it vividly, Mum, I've got this. And I really think she believed that because the bullies will have been dealt with by the school, that she had got this and this was okay and we were going to move on. And the day that she went back in, about 4 o'clock, I got a call from her. I was just on my way to collect her. And she was just hysterical and screaming, they're in my class, they're in my class. And it was one of those first days of school where you end up all of a little bit, you know, discombobulated. You end up doing lots of assemblies and going and looking at different lesson plans and whatnot. And it was only until the last lesson of the day that she'd found out that they were actually in her class, and not only in her class, but they were sitting either side of her. And that, for me, I remember driving home with her. She was beside herself. And in the end, I can remember it vividly. I still, when I drive past the place, berate myself slightly now, not fully. And I can just remember shouting, "We can't do this. We can't keep doing this." And when we got home, we spoke to the school and they said, "Oh yeah, we forgot. We forgot there was, we knew there was somebody else that we needed to maneuver." But really for us, that was it. And I think what that did was it broke the final thread of her trust in the school and really in the world. And in the book, she actually talks about the time where she realized that she didn't have any more control. She couldn't make any more change. And that was very painful to hear as a parent. And also because you think you're doing all the right things. You think you're trying to force your child into school because you think that's the thing that you should do. And actually what we really should have done at that time is just to listen to her, to give her a space where she could have shared the pain that she was feeling. Very palpable, very real pain. If you've ever been bullied or ostracized in that way, it is a very, very palpable pain. And it was very real in her life. And so we then found that it was almost impossible to get her to go into school. So within a couple of weeks, she wasn't leaving the house. She wasn't eating. She wasn't sleeping. And so I took her to see our GP, and he referred her to CAMHS, the Child Adolescent Mental Health Service, with a 9 to 12 week waiting list for an assessment. And my GP had been brilliant. He'd actually supported me. My husband had had some mental health issues about a decade, well, actually a little bit longer, but probably 15 years before that. And he'd been an absolute rock for me. And I think he saw that with my face, it was just, there's no way I can wait 9 to 12 weeks. You know, we're struggling to get through every day at the moment. And so he suggested that we came back to see him each week until the referral came through. And the following week, the first of those appointments, Izzy asked if she could go in on her own. And that was a little unusual, but I sat in the waiting room, not trying to think about it too much. And when they came out, he said, "Just go home. I'm going to give you a ring." And that call really did change the whole trajectory of all of our lives, because he said that she disclosed she had a plan to end her life that evening, and she'd stockpiled pills and she was going to take an overdose. So, you know, it's a massive shock as a parent. It's hugely upsetting. You have so many conflicting emotions, but the overriding one was, oh my goodness, I've got to keep my child alive. And how do I do that? None of my friends had ever been through it. Despite my husband's mental health challenges and mine when I was younger, I'd never been in this position. And I really tried to find the kind of support I needed, but I couldn't. And as you said at the beginning, you know, sitting on her floor, watching her breathe, willing her to want to live, I just couldn't understand why nobody else had been through this. And then it struck me, you know, it's a bit like when you have a baby, you sit in their room at 3 a.m. and it's the loneliest time in the world. And I thought, I can't be the only parent doing this. And so I thought, if we got through, and at that time it was a big if, then I'd make it a mission to make sure that no other parent felt like I did, which was completely out of my depth, emotionally set adrift. I had so many conflicting emotions, I didn't know how to deal with them. Not equipped at all as a parent to deal with this. And just so isolated, just so, so isolated. And so, yeah, as you say, about a year after that, fortunately, we kept her alive. And I started a Facebook group, and we're obviously now a charity as well. And unfortunately, my experience is not a singular one. And unfortunately, my experience is, although it's extreme, if you're listening to this and you've never had a child with a mental health issue, or you've never had any mental health issues yourself, I'm probably 7 out of 10 on the scale of what we see in our community. So it's, yeah, it's a huge, huge problem. And it's one that I'm really honored now that I can do something small to help families, really.
Really interesting. So when you say a huge problem, are you referring to the services around mental health, particularly in the UK, or are you talking about, I guess, the stigma that still exists around mental health, or both?
I think both, John. I think there's a huge stigma around mental health still. You know, we've had a lot of progress, I suppose, in talking about, actually, it's not really about talking about mental health. It's about acknowledging that it's there. Yeah. But when you say to somebody, it's good to talk, yes, it is, but then what? And what we find is that, particularly with young people's mental health, parents have to go through, well, the young people themselves have to go through, almost jump through hoops to prove that they're not making this up. And I'm using air quotes here, not that you can see them. And I think as parents, one of the overriding, we did a recent survey and 68% of parents felt that they were blamed by the services for their child's mental health. Now, whether or not that's accurate, that's how the parents feel. So if that's the kind of state of the energy, the place that we come together with the professionals, then that's a challenging position to start from. I think the stigma of being a parent of a young person with mental health issues is huge, because it reflects so much on, you know, parenting. Like, that says you're not a good parent and you must have done something and you should have seen it. And I'll hold my hand up. I should have seen it, but I don't know. I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know whether if I'd have supported Izzy in a different way earlier, would we have still been there? Maybe, maybe not. I'm not sure. But I think in terms of the services, because the numbers of young people who are struggling with their mental health is increasing, and actually we've got a huge gap in terms of how we deal with mental health, not just, I don't mean just medically or clinically, I mean in terms of society. So, you know, a lot of schools don't understand a child having anxiety, and they don't deal with it in that way. We're still looking at, I don't like the term school refusal. So there are some amazing teachers out there, some amazing professionals out there, but there's also, at a systemic level, challenges around how we see mental health, poor mental health in young people. And I think there's still this kind of hangover from the previous generation that in some way they're making it up, or in some way they don't know their own mind. Or also, the other one that I hear is, you know, what have they got to be, you know, worried about? What have they got to be upset or anxious about or depressed about? Well, actually, after the last 12 months or 18 months, actually, they've got quite a lot to be depressed about, not only in terms of their future, but also the things that they've experienced through COVID. So the isolation, the loss. And I think we've got to really listen to young people. And I'm sorry, I've gone on a convoluted journey there. But the stigma that still exists is one that I find on two levels. So there is the stigma around why children and young people become mentally unwell, but there's also the stigma around parenting, which is, if you have a child with a mental health issue, then in some way you're a sub-parent and you've done something wrong. And part of my work is to shine a light on that and say, that's not the case. This happens to parents of every, and families of, in every demographic, of every income range, of every education range. There's not some kind of poor parent stereotype that we can look to. So I think, yeah, if we can start to talk about this more, then we can also understand the impacts, not only on the individual child, the parents, the wider family. And then we look at going into things like employment, into companies, the impact it has on that, and the impact it has on society, because we have a whole load of young people that are disenfranchised, that don't believe that they fit, they don't believe that they're heard, they don't believe that they're seen.
So you talk about employment there, and, you know, and obviously you said part of the way that we can tackle stigma is to talk about it more. But I just wonder, I guess that's quite a big challenge, isn't it, when sometimes in society, as you inferred to there, people still see mental illness as a weakness. People almost sometimes feel ashamed of that side of them, and they might think that it could potentially harm their career if they come out and say they're struggling with their mental health. So how do you deal with something like that, in terms of it being ingrained in society? and people being fearful of coming out and saying that they're struggling to cope.
Yeah, it's a terrible thing, that, isn't it? That actually this is, we're perpetuating a stigma actually by our silence. And so that's why it's so important for me to talk about this and to share what I did wrong, what I did right. And not only the difficulty of having a child who is suicidal and all of the stigma that you place upon yourself, all of the shame and the guilt and the blame, but also about the opportunity that it offers. And I think I know a lot of parents roll their eyes when I talk about the opportunity of this, you know, when you've had your child sitting on your kitchen floor begging you to allow them to die. Then you kind of get to a point in your life when you think, well, what could be worse? What else is there? And I think what I did with it was to try and flip it and try and see where these positives are. Going back to your point about companies, about organizations, about talking about this and increasing the stigma, I think that there are a lot of quite progressive companies that are starting to understand the impact of caring for somebody with a mental health issue. And I think it's the conversations we have in our houses. It's the conversations, it's the way we approach our children. You know, Parenting Mental Health's mission is to end generational mental illness. And what we mean by that is, well, if we change the way that we interact with our children today, if we listen to their needs, understand their needs, create that emotional safe space so that they can express that, and we empower them, we give them agency to not only understand their own mental health and not to feel ashamed about it, but to understand that somebody is listening and that we do care, then the way that they will deal with their children when they have mental health issues, and let's be honest, we all have mental health issues. We might not end up with mental illness, but we all have mental health issues. Then that will change that dynamic again. And I think the conversations we have in our houses, the way we approach it, the way that we don't blame ourselves, we try and step away from that blame and shame position, which is very, very easy to do, is the way that we start doing that. And I think the challenge with that is that we have this track, don't we? This success track that we're told is the way that we live a good, meaningful, purposeful life. And for us, that was, you know, it's challenging to come off of that. You know, I was, you know, clamoring, holding on, just desperate to stay on this track because I kind of thought I knew what I was getting. You know, that certainty of, you know, she was at a good school and she'd get a good grades and off she'd go to a good university and she'd do all these things that what I was told were good. That's what you do. And actually what mental illness did for us was it broke open possibility. And it was brutal and it was dark and it was very, very challenging. So I'm not being flippant in saying that. But I think if we can look at this, when we face this challenge, the first thing we have to do is acknowledge what we're facing. And that's very difficult for us at times. But I think if we can be compassionate, if we can not judge ourselves, then we can talk about it and change the narrative around it. So it isn't something that we see as a weakness. You know, I look at the people that I love the most in the world are highly creative people who struggle with their mental health. And that's kind of part, we need to look at it as a different way. It's not something that's bad. It's not something that's shows how weak we are. In many cases, those with poor mental health are the strongest of us because they fight an invisible battle every day and they still turn up. So yeah, it's a hard one. It's a difficult one. It's going to take generations for us to change that. But I really hope that if we can continue to talk, but also then put the systems in place so that we can support, that we might be able to change how we perceive this.
I wonder what your thoughts were on media representation of people with mental health issues. What role do you think the media plays? And often, not always, sometimes the media will play into stereotypes when it comes to mental health conditions or any kind of neurological condition.
Definitely. Yeah, I think the challenge we've got is if you haven't experienced something, you simply look at the kind of, you know, the common denominator. So if you are talking about somebody who has bipolar, then you think about these kinds of traits. If you are thinking about somebody who is depressed, then you think about these kind of traits, and the same with neurodiversity as well. I think the challenge we've got is that we need to stop looking at the diagnosis. We need to start looking at the person, because when you have a mental illness and you have a diagnosis, that diagnosis is there not to define you. It's there to help you to get access to better treatment. Like this pathway, this clinical pathway may well help you better because of your diagnosis. But I think it's really easy as a society, we try and simplify everything. Let's distill it all down to, oh, they're depressed, oh, they're manic, whatever it, you know, whatever it is. So I think we've got a lot of work to do there. And it's heartening, you know, you can start to see some different representations in the media, but it's far and few between.
And yeah, I guess the best way forward in terms of media representation is involving people with lived mental health experience in the production process, the development phase of any production, and that way you're going to see more accurate, fair representation on screen in the future, I would say.
Yeah, definitely. I think as well that lived experience piece has such an important role to play in terms of, you know, in every understanding, every way that we approach mental illness, mental health. So for us, lived experience is a vital part of the narrative around how we deal with this, how we approach it, how we support young people, everyone really, with mental health issues. So yeah, I agree with you there. And I also think that the point is that, you know, I think we just need to challenge ourselves before we even start considering why we're looking at portraying mental illness on poor mental health. Yeah. And what is the purpose of that? Is it to maybe show the person behind it, or is it there as almost like a badge, as a shortcut to some kind of understanding? I don't know.
Yeah. I want to go back to talking about your charity. So just tell us again how you went from a Facebook group to, an international charity.
Yeah, it's pretty wild story there, isn't it? Well, I started the Facebook group because it felt to me the easiest way to connect with parents. I would sit in the CAMS waiting room and try and make eye contact with other parents that were coming in. Unfortunately, it was a shared space, so there was a physio in there as well. And a lot of the times, you know, I'd be looking at people thinking, oh, you're going through the same thing as me. And actually they'd gone in because they've got a problem with their knee. So that was kind of, there was a flaw to my plan there. I couldn't actually connect with the people that I wanted to. And so the Facebook group felt like the right place to start. And gradually it grew. It was reasonably small, but for me at the time, all I wanted to do was to make sure that it was meaningful and helpful to the people that were in there. And then in 2018, Facebook approached me, and obviously from whatever the data was that they could see, I was asked to apply for a program for their most meaningful community leaders, and I was selected for that. And 100 of us were taken out to their headquarters, and we shared how to grow community, how to make meaningful change. And through that process, I decided that we would become a charity, not really because I wanted to run a charity, but because I feel that there's a gap. I feel that there's a need for parents to be supported. We absolutely believe that parents are part of the solution. They have huge insight, huge intuition, and also they're there 24/7. And it's the same as if, you know, you had a physical illness that you didn't know anything about. You know, we wouldn't ostracize or make parents feel bad about that. We would support them, we would educate them, we would help them, we would skill them. And that's what we aim to do now. So we got our charity status just before lockdown in 2020, which was not brilliant timing, but we've been really fortunate since then to have a fantastic trustee board. Fantastic. We've got 260 volunteers who help us out. And we're very proud of the work that we do, and we've got a big task ahead. We want to help 1 million parents, but I think, you know, hopefully we can do that. And sad that we need to, but actually I think, you know, the need is there.
Absolutely. Suzanne, so I want to talk a bit about your book, Never Let Go: How to Parent Your Child Through Mental Illness. So how did that come about, and was it actually a therapeutic process for you to write it?
Oh, it was a wonderful process. I always thought I wanted to write a book, but I thought it would be some kind of Agatha Christie crime thriller. And in the end, it's turned out to be a book that was very personal. It was cathartic to write it. I'd really shared my experience, my journey in the Facebook community. And so a lot of it I'd been through already. But the actual act of writing it was very therapeutic for me. And what I wanted it to be was the book that I'd needed at the time. You know, if I have a problem, I go out and buy a book. That's my mode of, I don't Google, I go and buy a book. That's the way that I work. And what I wanted was this book to be what I needed at the time. So I needed a companion. And I kind of felt like I wanted something where people could write in the columns, you know, in the on the pages and underline things and highlight things. And I've heard from a lot of parents that that's what they've done, things that spoke to them or reminders that they needed. And so it's part about our story, but all of it is around the method of partnering, not parenting, which was the different approach that I took and devised when Izzy became ill. And so not only do we share the experiences that we had, Izzy is in the book, she contributes to it, and she also illustrated it. But we talk about the partnering, not parenting approach and how it can help parents when their young people have poor mental health.
So for any parent listening to this podcast, maybe they're anywhere in the world and they're really kind of relating to what you're saying right now, how can they get in touch and find out more about you and what you do?
So you can get in touch with the charity either by going to parentingmentalhealth.com or by searching for Parenting Mental Health on Facebook. We have a closed support community there, which offers 24-hour, 7 days a week, 365 days a year peer support. And there's a lot of resources in there as well, a lot of resources available and support for parents. And if you wanted to get in touch with me, I have my own website, suzannealderson.com.
And I should say, if you are a young person also listening to this podcast and you can also relate to what your daughter has been through and perhaps you're struggling right now, what advice would you give to them?
Well, I think there's some great support out there for young people. Organisations like The Mix, Young Minds, Cuth, there's lots of online platforms where you can go and talk to somebody. And I think that's the key, is go and talk to somebody. You know, what you're going through is sadly not unusual, but you don't have to go through it on your own. And I would also go and speak to your parents. And if you're a parent listening to this, go and see a GP, go and get some professional support. What I would say as well is that actually I think sometimes we think that going to the professionals is going to be it and it's going to fix it. And actually you can't fix this. You have to go through it. It's not something that you can just fix and it will go away. So I think being patient, being consistent, being calm, being compassionate are really, really key points. But reach out. There's a lot of great support out there. A lot of great charities doing a lot of good work. And sometimes, you know, you might have to go privately. You might not be able to get through the CAMHS system or the adult mental health system. But, you know, you're not alone. And I would go out and find like-minded people. Go and find a community of support for you, because that really does sustain you. It can be a very isolating journey. So I definitely suggest that go and find your people. They are out there.
A couple of more questions as we come towards the end of today's podcast. And this is a question I ask all my guests on the Different Minds podcast series. And Susanna, what advice would you give your younger self if you had the opportunity?
Oh my goodness, John, what a question. Wow, how long have we got? Like, seriously, how long have we got? So I would give my younger self the advice just to believe in yourself. I suffered quite a lot of trauma in my teenage years, and I didn't believe in myself. I always believed that what happened to me was my fault. And so I would just believe in yourself, just absolutely. And it sounds really simple, and it's the kind of thing that, you know, I'm sure lots of people might say, but actually for me, it was so important. If I'd believed in myself rather than believing other people, then yeah, who knows where I'd end up, but I'm quite happy to be here talking to you and doing the work that I'm doing. But yeah, I think believe in myself and listen to my own intuition more. It hasn't failed me. Tends to be when I listen to other people that it lets me down. So yeah,
that's really good advice. Thank you. And the final question is, how is your daughter doing now?
Oh, she's doing great. Thank you. Yeah, she's at university. She's in her final year at uni. She was out of school for 2 years, and one day she just decided that she would like to go to college. She was interested. A friend had recommended a college that did a game design course, because gaming was something that had really sustained her through her illness, and she'd become very good at it. And she went to college, and she got top marks in her BTEC there, and she got a place at university. And like I say, she's in her third year now. She's doing great. She's learned a lot. She's got compassion and insight beyond her years. And I wish sometimes that she didn't have that, because, you know, I didn't want her to go through what she did. But actually, it's made her an incredibly calm, very compassionate, very kind, very thoughtful, very insightful person. And she's been great, because she actually really supports the charity as well. So if you come and join us in the Facebook community, there are lots of Q&As and lots of video sessions that we've done together, because like me, she doesn't really want anybody else to feel isolated and alone.
Really great to hear. Suzanne, thank you so much for talking to us today. It's great to hear about the fascinating work that you're doing, and you are creating meaningful change. And as you say, that compassion is something that, you know, we all need to kind of focus on. And yeah, it's just kind of really inspiring to hear your story. So yeah, keep up the good work.
Thank you, John. Thanks for having me.